Well, I know you spent a long time writing this book, researching this book, and you've said that the story of how Catherine got to the throne is as compelling as what happened when she got there.
Yes, I very much so. And that's related in some sense to the fact that I have four daughters, and I've watched them all grow up. A couple of them are still growing up, and becoming women or young women, and dealing with life as a girl and as a woman. And I think it's fair to say that it's a little bit harder climb than we men have. It's still basically a man's world, and I've been very interested and proud of my daughters doing achieving what they've done. And when I started to read Catherine's memoirs and some of the material about her, I was very, very impressed by what this girl over 200 years ago, this little nobody, a German princess, but princesses were really a dime a dozen in Germany those days, and what she had done with her life, how she went from Germany, a little corner of Germany, to Russia and became the Empress, and all the things she achieved. And I was very struck by it. And I really think one of the things I thought of more and more as I was writing the book, there's a lesson in this life, not just for what she did, which was remarkable in the 18th century, but for women today. I can defend that or elaborate on it at length, but that's my reason.
What was Catherine like as an adult? Was she someone you would like to spend time with?
Yes, very much. In fact, Rick, when I put everything down and closed my computer and the book went off to the publisher and all those things, I was sad. I'd lost a good friend. She wasn't perfect. None of us are. But she was, as I said before, indeed unique. I have said in the book that I think she and Elizabeth I of England were the two women monarchs of the great monarchical age who stood out. And even compared to men, they rose above most of the males on thrones. So I had a very interesting time with my little sort of silent dialogue with her, and I was very sad, almost lonely for a while when we said goodbye.
Did she leave behind a significant amount of written material that you could call upon?
Yes, she did, and that's why the first part of my book, the first half of my book, is so important. She wrote her memoirs. She didn't sit down and start from the beginning and write all the way through, but she wrote in the form of long letters or long explanations of who she was and where she had come from to, for example, the British ambassador, to her son, to her grandson, and so forth. She really told her own story, and it provided such a wealth of material, of specifics about her childhood and her relationships with her mother and her husband and the people in Russia, that it's not biographers and writers have to get historians have to get what they can where they can. So it's not exactly plagiarism, but I was able to use a great deal of this stuff, and it made the book, my book, I think, much more complete and, if I could say so, richer.
Did you learn anything about her during your work that really surprised you?
There are legends, stories, myths about Catherine that have gone around, mostly among people who don't know that much, and maybe they would like to, but they haven't had access to the facts. She's been called all sorts of names. She's been criticized for her private life. She's been criticized for not getting rid of serfdom while she was empress, and various other things. And I was able to, I think, to explain in my book these challenges unmet, as well as the challenges met. And I did learn some things, both good and not so good. And I believe in biography should not just be a puff job, but warts and all, as somebody said. So that's what my book tries to be.
I know one of the more salacious myths about her is how she died. She actually died of a stroke, and she wasn't involved in some sex act with a horse or anything like that.
Well, that is the most prevalent story, and it's absolutely ridiculous. I was born in Lexington, not far from you, and my daughter lives there now and is in the horse world, and you know, she said the idea of behind this story is absolutely fantastically impossible.
How do you think that got started?
It got started specifically by people who didn't like her, mostly in other countries, specifically in France and in Turkey, the Ottoman Empire. Well, that was particularly absurd because in France, her contemporary was Louis the XV, who had on the grounds of the estate at Versailles a training school where adolescent girls were brought in to be trained to please the king in bed. And he went through a very, very great number. In Turkey, or the Ottoman Empire, as we know, the Sultan had a harem of 200 or 300 people. And yet from these stories, from these places, came this false and exaggerated and ludicrous myth. Catherine had 12 lovers. And when you realize or read that she lay in bed next to her husband for 9 years and he would not touch her before they drifted apart. They didn't divorce, but they drifted apart. That's enough of a motivation for any woman to look for some kind of affection somewhere else. And one of the lovers was her support for 12 years. I mean, it wasn't even an Elizabeth Taylor thing. So I don't know. I've tried to be judicious and fair, and as I said, explain, but not excuse.
She had this young husband who had no interest in her sexually, and this is one of the many parallels that you draw between her and Marie Antoinette.
Yes, I did. But the reason for both of those husbands, Louis the XVI and Marie Antoinette, and Peter, who became Peter the Third, and Catherine, was some kind of a physical flaw, which I won't go into here, but I explain in my book.
So, of course, you've written previously about Russian royals, and I understand that the root of this, you kind of have a personal story behind your interest in this.
Yeah, I do. I do, Rick. My oldest child, now in his mid-50s, my son Bob Jr., was born with hemophilia out of the blue. And I had studied history at Yale, and then I was at Oxford where I read history for a couple more years, and I was very interested in how the hemophilia of the child, their only son, the heir to the throne, had affected these two parents back at the turn of the 19th and into the 20th century, and nobody was very much interested in it. They were interested in the sort of story of Rasputin and hypnotizing the child so he wouldn't suffer so much pain from bleeding into his knees and ankles and elbows. But there wasn't much information. And we even back then in the 1950s and 60s, had a lot of information about what this could do to a little boy. It appears only in boys, as you probably know. But and we were trying to compare, I was trying to compare in my first book, Nicholas and Alexandra, what this meant politically, what Rasputin's appearance meant to the Empress, and what impact it had on an admittedly declining and disintegrating Russian Tsarist system. That book, surprisingly for me, I was only in my late 30s, was a huge success. And as a book and as a Academy Award film and so forth. And I got, during the writing of that book, I became very interested in the rest of the Russian imperial story. I hadn't known anything about it. And I, my next book was a very long effort on Peter the Great, which was also pretty well received and won a Pulitzer. So I sort of, you know, publishers like you to stay in the same track, and I haven't always, but I've come back partly because of great interest in this family. And all of the royal families of Europe had some kind of Damoclean sword hanging over them. It wasn't all just furs and jewels and palaces and servants and so forth, by a long shot.
Interesting stuff. What's next for you on the horizon?
Well, Rick, I don't really know. I've got a couple of ideas. This book is pretty successful, too, and I'm going around. As you may know, I'm coming to Louisville.
Yes.
In 10 days or so, and talking about it at libraries and dinners and luncheons and so forth. And I'm a very one-track person. I can't really start. When I do start another book, I will do nothing but that. But right now, I want to give Catherine as much running room as I can, and as long as people invite me, as your library has, I'm going to do that.
You mentioned you were born in Lexington. Do you have strong ties to Kentucky still?
Well, my daughter lives in Harrodsburg.
Oh,
her husband Jim Thomas is from Louisville originally, and he was for many years the president of the Shaker Village in Harrodsburg. Pleasant Hill. He ran that. He retired a few years ago. And Susanna, my daughter, is very involved in the horse industry, so to speak. Right now, she's head of an organization which is trying to save champion racehorses, not the great champions, but the ones who won significant amounts of money. And by taking them and finding foster homes for them, I guess you could say. And it's not an easy job, but she loves the horses, and she loves her. She's been down there for 25 years. And so, yeah, in Susanna, who I think will come to my lecture in Louisville, she is my present link to Kentucky.
Your lecture is at the Louisville Free Public Library on September 27th. The name of the book is Catherine the Great, Portrait of a Woman. Robert Massey, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Rick.